I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. There is a compelling book that's out entitled Mrs. Astor Regrets, The Hidden Betrayals of a Family Beyond Reproach. It is a well-researched and compelling book about a story that's consumed both the tabloids and broadsheets in Manhattan, but now with this book has fascinated many beyond New York and its surrounding area. Brooke Astor was a well-known and beloved philanthropist and socialite in New York, donating much money to the city, where her third husband's ancestors had made much of their fortune. She was a glittering institution for decades in the city that she loved and that loved her back. In her declining years, however, her grandson Philip Marshall sued his father, Mrs. Astor's son Anthony, alleging that she was being mistreated. The press had a field day, and Tony Marshall, in his 80s, and his wife Charlene, were forced to defend themselves in the court of public opinion, as well as in court over indictments that he had looted her vast estate. The author of Mrs. Astor Regrets joins me now, the acclaimed magazine writer Merrill Gordon, who also teaches in the graduate faculty of journalism at New York University. It's a tremendous book and endlessly fascinating. I'm perhaps the only reviewer who bought the book, which I did over the holidays, and I must admit I had trouble putting it down. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin and retails for $37.95. It is a bestseller in the United States and Canada already. I am very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Merrill Gordon. Good morning, Ms. Gordon.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm delighted you enjoyed the book.
Why do you think it is, Merrill, that this story has been so interesting to people, not only in New York, but well beyond?
You know, I think it works on a couple of different levels, one of which is it's rich people behaving badly, which is always a topic of enormous interest to the rest of us. And I also think that it's a story of family dysfunction. I mean, you kind of cannot believe that this famous, you know, legendary family would suddenly blow up in public and all of us would get to watch from the sidelines as they fought one another.
Was there a point when Philip Marshall filed this suit that he initially filed over guardianship of Mrs. Astor, that it could have been sealed and that we would never have known about this?
You know, what's fascinating about this whole saga and what I tried to do in the book is really lay out all the ways in which it didn't have to come to where it is today, which is that Tony Marshall is going on trial on February 23rd on charges that he looted his mother's estate. The initial guardianship was filed back in July of 2006. Philip Marshall, who was backed by Ned De La Renta, David Rockefeller, and Henry Kissinger, they had thought that the lawsuit would be sealed, and there was a sort of screw-up with the judge and the court clerk, and the next thing you know, a Daily News reporter got a tip and was able to dig up the file in the record room before it was sealed, and the next thing you know, this was all over the newspapers. Nobody really sought publicity about this initially, and they really thought this would be worked out behind closed doors, and said it was a huge public fight. What's been fascinating for me as a reporter, because I began covering it day one, is that nobody knew where this thing was going to go. The guardianship was settled in October of 2006, and Tony Marshall gave up guardianship of his mother. Annette De La Renta took over, and she brought Mrs. Astor from her Park Avenue apartment, where she had been kind of kept a little bit under wraps, and a lot of her staff had been fired. Annette brought her back to her country house, rehired the staff. Mrs. Astor made her happiness clear. She wasn't able to really speak very much at that point, but she put on 15 pounds. She was emaciated beforehand, and she conveyed her interest in life by eating again. But everybody thought once Tony Marshall and his wife agreed to give back a lot of property, paintings, jewelry, a lot of money, people thought this was over. But there was one little quirky moment. Brooke Astor's court-appointed lawyer had looked at all of Mrs. Astor's wills, and one of the signatures on the last codicil looked very different than earlier codicils and signatures on wills, so she had hired a handwriting expert. So 2 weeks after the guardianship case was settled and everybody thought this was over, the handwriting expert issued a report saying he believed that Brooke Astor's signature had been forged. And oh my God, you know, this was front page headlines. And the DA's district attorney in Manhattan began investigating, and it was an investigation that lasted a full year before they issued indictments in November of 2007. So that's where, but when I began working on this book, there really was no way of knowing all the kind of strange twists and turns along the way. And certainly Philip Marshall did not begin this guardianship with the idea that his father could face 25 years in jail.
There's some talk about his motive in doing this, and it sort of centers around this house, a vacation house in Maine, is it correct? Is that correct?
You know, this is sort of a complicated story, and I'll try to sort of go through it quickly, but initially, Burkester had left all of her property to her son, her New York apartment, her Westchester estate, and a house up in Maine. And the house in Maine had two guest cottages, one of them on the water. And when Philip Marshall visited his grandmother back in 2000, at the end of the visit, she said to him, "I'd like to give you the cottage on the water." And he was pleased. He thought that was a lovely gesture. But his father was very upset about this. His father wanted control of the entire property. So Tony Marshall said to Philip, you don't want this. You have to pay the taxes on it. I'll take care of it. You can use it all you want. And Tony said to his mother, I'd like to continue to be able to use this. It's winterized. So Burkester did not give the cottage to her grandson. There were some people who wonder whether that, entire thing was the motivation for Philip to eventually sue his father. That was not my impression in the interviews. It's not what I have in the book. I think there was genuine concern that Tony had fired a lot of her, Mrs. Astor's longtime employees, her social secretary, her butler, her chauffeur, and the apartment was kind of getting a little bit on the shabby side. The nurses also had some allegations that things were being done that they didn't understand. So I think his concern was for his grandmother's well-being, not revenge in some way over the cottage.
And then he doesn't gain anything. He'll probably not inherit anything from Tony after all this, right?
I've been fascinated by that, but I would be shocked if he did. I mean, both Philip and his fraternal twin brother Alec, Burkester left them $1 million in her will, dating back to 1992, and that will not change. But presumably, Tony Marshall, whatever happens when all these various courtroom fights, he's still going to be a very wealthy man. I mean, he still gets her Park Avenue apartment, which is now on sale for $34 million. If anybody has any extra spare change running around, and the Holly Hill estate in Westchester is on sale for $12 million, bargain in this current environment. So he will get both of these proceeds of these properties. He now owns the main estate. Plus, under all of her wills, he gets nearly $5 million a year. So he'll be wealthy regardless of what happens. There's other money he won't get depending on how these court cases turn out. But I would certainly be surprised that he would opt to leave any to his sons, given what's happened.
His wife, Charlene, she's younger than Tony, right?
By 20 years, yeah.
Yeah. Now, she doesn't come off very well in the press nor in your book. It's written that she's known for her, quote, ill-disguised avarice.
Well, she... she's a complicated figure, Charlene Marshall, and the one thing I do, I have a very strong impression that she and Tony really love each other, that essentially they're very close. This has been a fight that has brought them together rather than have taken them apart, so that I think one of the initial Taylor stories called her a gold digger, but I've always had the impression it's a very strong relationship, and it's based on love, not on money.
Has she come to any of your book signings?
No, she did go to one of the book signings of Frances Kiernan wrote a book called The Last Mrs. Astor, which is a biography of Burkester, but only had, at least the original paperback has more, but the original hardcover only had 9 pages about the fight. But yes, Charlene did come to one of Fran's readings, but she has not come to any of mine.
There's a story in the book, I guess this was Mrs. Astor's 100th birthday party, and there were flowers from Prince Charles, and I guess it says something about the relationship that Charlene had with Burkester.
When I began working on the book, I became fascinated by Burkester's 100th birthday party, which was given by David Rockefeller at his family's estate, and it's because I realized that almost everybody involved in this fight was there. Tony and Charlene were there. Philip Marshall was there, Annette Laurenta was there, Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller, of course, were there. Burkester's first lawyer, who was later fired by her son, Terry Christensen, was there. So to me, that evening was sort of fascinating as a kind of mirror, and the more stories I began to hear, I was totally intrigued when I talked to Viscount Astor of the British branch of the Astor family, who flew in and came to this event. And when he was staying with Mrs. Astor, who said to him, "Thank God you're here. I don't want to go to this party with my son and his wife. I don't want to walk in on their arms. I want you to take me." So it was kind of a little subtle dig at her son that he was not allowed to escort his mother. And then Barbara Walters and Liz Smith told me the story about the flowers, which is that Tony got up and he announced that his wife would be presenting flowers that were sent by Prince Charles. And when Charlene went over to the table to do so, Mrs. Astor made this expression of total sort of fury and upsetness, and kind of everybody was shocked because this was a public event, and Charlene was trying to do something that was in some ways a warm gesture, and it really kind of a hush went around the room when people realized that, you know, she was quite old at that point. She was 100, Mrs. Astor, so that was a point when I guess she didn't feel she had to hide her feelings, and they were very clear. So it was a hurtful moment for Charlene in many ways, and also to be dissed in front of her mother-in-law's famous friends.
This also says something about the Astors themselves, and it speaks to the subtitle of the book, the Hidden Betrayals of a Family Beyond Reproach, that the Astors, I guess, they're beyond reproach because these sorts of things, these squabbles that go on in one's family, don't usually make the headlines, but in the Astor case, they have.
Well, it's, Burke Astor really burnished the Astor name in a book called Who Killed Society by Cleveland Amory that came out in 1959. He looks at all the famous families of America, you know, the Vanderbilts and the DuPonts and the Astors, and at that point he talks about how the Astors had kind of become, they were sort of known for their hijinks and divorces and screwed up lives in some ways, and Brooke Astor came along and suddenly she turned that name into this sort of shining, it became synonymous with philanthropy, with doing good things for the, you know, for New York City, and people, you know, people just, when they heard the Astor name, they thought positive things, and of course now this whole scandal has changed the dynamics.
And as a reporter, it must be fascinating because it's a very old-fashioned world, isn't it? It's very much an aristocracy rather than a meritocracy.
Well, for me, what was fun, I've written, a lot of my stories have been on politics. John Kerry, Howard Dean, Kofi Annan, I profiled Mike Bloomberg, Mayor of New York. I've also done a lot of celebrity profiles, but I have not been really steeped into the whole Upper East Side world. So I felt like an anthropologist trying to understand the mores of this world. And what was great for me is it was both a upstairs-downstairs story. So I talked to Nancy Reagan and Annette De Laurenta and Barbara Walters and all of these rather famous figures, but I also talked to Burke Astor's, you know, social secretaries and chauffeurs and butlers and nurses and gardeners. And it was wonderful to get these sort of two different views of her and of these worlds.
And you talked to the staff. Was it the nurses? Were they the ones initially who sounded the alarm?
Actually, it was Christopher Ely, who was Burke Astor's butler in Westchester, who very devoted to her. He's someone who had worked in Buckingham Palace, and she really loved him and begged him to stay with her until her death, and in fact put a clause into her will that if he was still working for her, he would get $50,000 upon her death. And he, when Brooke turned about, it was a little before her 100th birthday, she really began to deteriorate mentally, and Chris went to Brooke's son, Tony, and said, you know, he was really concerned. Tony took his mother to a doctor, and she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he didn't tell that many people, but he did tell Chris, because Chris was taking care of her. She came to the country every weekend. She would spend her time in the city of New York. Suddenly, Chris begins to hear stories. Once Brooke broke her hip in 2003, she was 101, she had round-the-clock care. I mean, she was able to get up and get around, but nurses are with her day and night the rest of her life. And when Chris began to hear these stories about lawyers turning up and things being signed, he was deeply concerned about what was going on, because he thought, my gosh, she has Alzheimer's. How can she be signing, dealing with lawyers? So he asked the nurses to take notes. You know, they heard or saw anything that was out of the ordinary. And so they really kept these rather extraordinary notes that they don't just detail her, you know, her temperature and her ailments. It's all about her dreams, her nightmares, her reactions to visitors, what she did before and after she signed things. And all of these notes will be an important part of the criminal case, which starts in several weeks.
There's also that story about the letter that after that visit to the doctor, after she was diagnosed, that this was before she was diagnosed, where Tony Marshall was trying to tell the doctor about his frustrations sort of dealing with his mother and that he suspected she had Alzheimer's.
And this letter, there are times when you read through all this, even if you may have some questions about Tony Marshall's behavior, there's still some moments that are kind of, they're fascinating and sad because things that he did are being used against him, and one of the things is this letter. He had taken his mother to see the doctor, he'd gotten this diagnosis, and he wrote this letter that was kind of a letter of pure pain. It was really all about, I asked my mother, she doesn't remember anything, she's incontinent when I take her out, she says really hurtful things, and she doesn't, she asked me how much I earn, and doesn't seem to know the meaning of money, which is kind of fascinating because she was paying his salary. And when this letter emerged, it was kind of one of these red letter things because it proved that he knew that his mother had Alzheimer's at a point when he was asking her to sign all these documents.
The Marshalls spoke to you, but they didn't give you an actual interview, did they?
It was really complicated. I had initially written a piece for New York Magazine. They didn't like the piece. So I asked throughout the entire time for a formal interview, and they wouldn't do that. At the same time, they gave me, I called Tony. I got him for half an hour on the phone outside court one day. I sat with them, and I ended up taking out the notebook. We chatted for about an hour. Towards the end of the book, when I was finished the process, they gave me photographs, which I thought was incredibly gracious to use in the book, and a certain amount of fact-checking back and forth. So I would have liked a lot more access, but I feel like I got enough to try to present their version of the story.
Have you heard from them since the book came out?
I have not. I was in court a couple of weeks ago, and they were not there. I left a book at their apartment. I have heard from Francis Morrissey, who is a lawyer who is also charged with... he's charged with forgery, and Mr. Morrissey has been very pleasant to me, and I've heard from a number of other people in the book who mostly seem okay with it.
Morrissey was okay with the book.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far.
I would say that
he wrote me a thank you note for sending him the book. He's a very polite man, and when I saw him in court, he was very cordial, and we had a pleasant chat.
See, this says something about what I think, and I follow the case here in Vancouver. I read the post on the Daily News online, and so I have my own idea about what happened here and what I think and what, whether he's guilty or not, whether Marshall and Morrissey are. What does the case look like to you coming up later this month? Does it look like he could face time? And I mean, he looks like he could face time. Will he?
He's 84 years old, and I think I had been expecting all along there would be a plea bargain of some sort or another, but it seems pretty clear, unless there's some last-minute thing. I think they're all moving ahead. I mean, they're subpoenaing witnesses, there's another hearing on Friday, and in many situations, defense and prosecutors are sort of collegial. In this case, they really seem like they hate each other. I mean, it's just the vitriol in court is rather extraordinary. I think Tony Marshall really... he wears his Marine Corps tie and tie pin. I think he believes in his heart he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, I think the case that he's arguing is that his mother loved him. She didn't treat him well all of his life, and at the end she wanted to make amends and she wanted to give him all this money to make up for behavior before. I mean, there are issues about he's been charged with stealing paintings, but the main charge against him is that in the second codicil of her will, Burkaster was going to leave $60 million to charity, and instead she leaves all of that money to her son. And the prosecutor's point is the woman had Alzheimer's, she was over 100 years old. They find it really suspect that she could suddenly have changed her behavior. And Tony had fired her old-time lawyer and brought in Francis Morrissey, who brought in some other lawyers. And so the feeling is that she did not know what she was doing. The hardest thing, I think, from what I've been told in cases like this, is that people who are old and even have Alzheimer's, they can be in and they can be out. They can have a good 2 hours, they can have a bad 2 hours. And I think the Tony Marshall's lawyers will try to prove that she was competent, at least during the period in which she signed all these things. And the prosecutors will try to prove that she wasn't.
In New York, though, as a reporter, do you? I mean, people really, they don't like Tony Marshall. They don't like Charlene, do they?
Well, they have friends who have stood by them through all of this. I mean, and they, one of the things, I called as many of their friends I could track down, and Marshall's basically told their friends to speak to me. So they have a cadre of, you know, Whoopi Goldberg is a close friend of theirs. She came to Brickaster's funeral and sat with them. There are people in the theatrical community because Tony was a producer. Members of Charlene's church, they're very involved in a church. So they do have their friends, but I think the overall court of public opinion has been guilty, guilty, guilty.
Say, did you ever meet Mrs. Astor?
Briefly once, and I was an event at the New York Public Library, and I was, you know, I shook her hand for 2 seconds. She was completely charming. Obviously, nothing would have made me happier than to have been able to spend some time with her. There's so much I would have liked to have asked, but by the time I began working on the book, again, she was not in good mental health, and it was unclear whether she really recognized people anymore, and I was not able to see her.
Do you think she had any idea near the end there, while this was all going on, what was going on?
I wonder. I mean, it's interesting to me because her intimates say that they didn't really know how much she was aware, but at the same time, her minister said they went to see her, and he gave her communion. She made the sign of the cross. And that says to me she had some awareness of that, that when people talked to her, she seemed to respond and spark up. Even a week or so before she died, she was upstairs, and she'd had a bad night, and her brother Chris Healy was calling up to the nurses saying, you know, maybe she shouldn't come downstairs because she's not feeling well. And the nurse and social workers were telling me that she shook her head, this is after she wanted to go downstairs. And so I think she was more aware of what was going on. They didn't have newspapers in the house. They didn't, you know, there was one point where I think Annette De Laurenta and Brookaster's court-appointed lawyer were sort of quietly talking in a corner of the room, and they were lectured by the butler, don't talk about any of these things. Because, so, I mean, I have to assume she sensed something was amiss, but we'll never know what she knew or didn't know.
Finally, Meryl, one of the reviewers that I was reading, reviews of the book, I should say, one of the reviewers asked why this book now and why not after the trial?
Well, you know, I have been criticized for this. I think, I guess I'll say a couple things, one of which is that the trial has been postponed. It was initially going to be in November, and it has, you know, it's... We didn't know when this was going to happen or even if it was going to happen, and decided to move ahead with the book. And I will obviously cover this in the paperback that will be coming out. It was also, to be honest, I'm the only game in town. I'm the only person with the book out. I was concerned that if I waited much longer, I would have had 17 other books competing against mine. And I think it also, this sets the groundwork. I think it kind of lays out the situation. It kind of allows you to decide what you think about the characters, and there is suspense in what's going to happen next.
Meryl, thanks so much for joining us today. Congratulations on this book. I've told you, you know, privately that this is how much I enjoyed this book, how terribly fascinating it is. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
The book is called Mrs. Astor Regrets the Hidden Betrayals of a Family Beyond Reproach, $37.95 from Houghton Mifflin. Meryl Gordon on the line. I'm Joseph Plato.